Now entering Nerdist.com.
Alright, I've talked Scott Sigler into coming up to my hotel room. Shit's gonna get real, Scott. Alright, so first of all, thank you for coming up to my hotel room.
Thank you. Appreciate the chance to be on the podcast. I'm very excited.
Well, you're the first author. I mean, other people have been on, have written books, but okay. You're the first pure strain of author who's been on.
Yep.
And for me, it's pretty exciting. Let me go into airplane mode here.
Okay.
For me, it's incredibly exciting because, I took on contributors for my website, a month ago. And it was mainly just a way for me to, I can't blog every day, and I feel like stuff that I'm writing about is from a limited perspective, and I want to kind of make the site more robust. Mm-hmm. And so, all these people offered to contribute. And someone wrote and said, "Oh, I want to review books." And I was like, "You have to review books. I want the site to, I want along with all the wiener jokes that I make on the site, I want some academic feel. I want the site to be literate.
The literati, yes.
Yeah. So Jessica Barton is the writer, and she's been reviewing all these great books, mm-hmm. and it's opened me up to a lot of new stuff, and she."
Yeah.
One of the nicest things is that some of the authors that she's been writing about have started commenting in the threads, like you did.
Yep, yep.
And so, and then you and I kind of tweeted back and forth, and I said, "This Scott Sigler guy is delightful. We must get him on the podcast." She wrote about Ancestor.
Yeah, she did. The one that just came out last week.
And she loved it.
Yes.
And she must have read it in an hour, because I feel like it came out on a Tuesday, and she had already, she'd already put the review up Wednesday to post Friday.
Yeah, and that seems to be a common thread with this one, is that people are sitting down and reading it in one go, which mm-hmm. is what you're always shooting for as an author. If I can, destroy an evening's productivity and make you late to work the next day, well then, I win. So that's how it works.
That's fantastic, because I don't normally read a lot of fiction because... It's time, and I've said this on the podcast before, but I'm like a productivity is sort of my religion, I guess.
Okay.
And so I spend a lot of time like reading books about how to manage time and how to mm-hmm. how to move life elements around to mm-hmm. so that everything kind of works in synchrony. But the idea of a crazy sci-fi books is very appealing to me. Very, very appealing.
Well, my kind of stuff, especially if you are leaning more towards the science side, there's some but not a lot of authors who consider themselves horror authors who are using real hard science to communicate the scares mm-hmm. and to make it more believable and plausible and let you dive in further. So for people of that mindset, my stuff is really cool escapism.
What's your background?
Background is just journalism and marketing, but the decision to go into journalism was touch and go with going into the sciences. Mm-hmm. But since I was lazy and writing was very easy, I was like, this will be like stealing. They're going to pay me to write. So went into that in college and just generally follow the sciences from a pop culture level. Mm-hmm. And then I've been giving away all my books as free podcasts for 5 years now.
I wanted to talk to you about that because that's a fantastic model. Well, we'll get to that in a sec. I want to find out. So what makes you decide to write your first book pitch, and what does your proposal look like, and mm-hmm. Was there a rejection process or did it get like what? Just walk us through that a little.
It was about 15 years ago or maybe more that I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm making the decision. I've always wanted to be a novelist, but I'm going for it. This is my life's aspiration. Mm-hmm. And spent 12 years going through the standard process that you've described. Writing the one-page pitch letter, going to conventions, trying to talk to agents, trying to talk to publishers. Pretty much spent probably 6 years where every vacation day was going to one mm-hmm. convention or another, trying to meet people, make connections, and stacked up a good 120 rejection letters for all my books.
Do those book conventions actually work, or is it sort of because
they can?
That's good, because in the entertainment, in the acting world, sometimes they'll have these Actors Showcase, yeah, and agents will show up, but it's kind of bullshit.
Sometimes they work in the book world. I got my first agent from one of those things, from World Horror Convention in Niagara Falls, and part of the deal was you get to sit down with three agents, all of whom will read the first two chapters of your novel, and that wound up, shockingly, landing me an agent, and was with him for 9 years, and we didn't get anything published, but it certainly wasn't for lack of trying on his part. He worked really hard, but it was just not the right mix. He was more of a hard science fiction author, which is, you know, spaceships, mm-hmm, and I don't write about spaceships. So we couldn't make the right connections. So yeah, they can work. And if you want to go to those things and work them, you can make connections. And a lot of times in publishing, it is about who you know, who was your roommate in college,
right,
you know, who your mom knows. I mean, quite frankly, that's largely what, if your dad's a famous writer, those things make a significant difference, not only getting a publishing deal, but also, you know, how much promotion you get when you come out of the gate. But having none of those things, I had to find another way to do it. And after 12 years of trying it, I just started giving away my books free as podcasts online, assuming, you know, understanding the internet culture a little bit. I'm like, well, if these things are free online, people will listen to them, because why the hell not? They're free, doesn't hurt nothing. And then if they like them, they'll start sending the links to those audio files via IM, chat rooms, etc., okay, post them on blogs, and then word of mouth could spread.
So it wasn't so much exasperation as like, oh fuck, I might as well just give this away. You were just, you actually thought, oh wait a minute, I actually see. And what year was this that you decided?
I started in 2005, March 2005. Yeah,
that's actually. I'm going to say that's ahead of the curve. That's ahead of Chris Anderson's free philosophy by a few years. That actually beats Radiohead's In Rainbows by a couple of years.
It does, yeah. And I mean, it was before before podcasts were even in iTunes.
Yeah.
And to figure out how to get a podcast back then was very confusing, at least to me. I'm kind of a tech tard, so figuring out how to do it. But no, right off the bat, when I saw podcasting, I said, oh, wow, this is a great way to distribute serialized audiobooks, just like they did of the radio plays in the 40s and 50s. Went out looking for some to listen to. When I couldn't find any, I was like, holy shit, nobody's done this yet. And then the marketing background kicked in. And I thought it was, my initial thought was, if I could get 10,000 people listening to my books, New York Publishing would be kicking in my door and beating me over the head with money to sign me. That didn't actually happen. So,
did they gently caress you with money?
They didn't do anything.
Did they make love to you in a blanket of money?
I got to 10,000 listeners and they're like, what's the internet?
Well, that's what, you know, the funny thing is, podcasts are, I almost wish there was a different name than podcasts, because for some reason I feel like the name doesn't really represent how powerful of a medium I think it is, because when you tell someone you have a podcast and they're like, that's adorable, did your mom drive you to that? You know, but really, and as I've said before, podcasts have the best audience. Like, they go out of their way to listen.
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful, you know, fans, and I feel like that the mainstream media, I'm still not sure that they have even really started seeing it as a really viable way to promote stuff.
By and large, they haven't. Shockingly, NPR gets podcasts and has been a cutting edge proponent of that. And then the other end of the spectrum is ESPN.
We're trying to really kick This American Life off the top of the podcast charts. It is impossible.
It's up there forever. So
fucking Ira Glass.
Yeah, he's crazy. He's crazy. I hear he's doing a lot of meth these days. So I don't know how his career is going
to
turn out.
Well, that's how he's able to put up all those podcasts.
Well, there you go.
The top.
He never fucking sleeps. Okay.
Listen, I don't want to get sued for libelous or slanderous comments, but I know for a fact that Ira Glass's blood is made of meth at this point. He is flying across the city.
But the biggest thing about podcasts, the time-delayed part of it, and people can go get it when they want, and then, you know, the tribal or cliquish nature of the online world, as soon as you find a podcast that you dig, you kind of send it out to your buddies, and since it's all email, IM, blog post, etc., it just, things can spread so fast. So if you do something well, and then do it consistently, which is the other key, you've got to keep stuff coming out on a regular basis, you can rack up some pretty big numbers. But it's awesome, because it's, you know, here I got free global distribution of all my audiobooks. I get to do exactly what I want. Nobody can control me or edit me. I give the whole thing away unabridged for free, which I was, due to my print deal, I was able to get that in my contract. So I'm, you know, one of the few guys who can get away with it. But, you know, I've got fans all over the world who will never even see one of my books in their stores, because I'm not in those markets yet. So I love podcasts. It's amazing.
And so how long did it take you to get to 10,000?
With Earthcore, that was the first one I put out. Started in March of 2005. Like the first episode had 3 downloads, and one was my mom. Nice job, honey. This is fascinating. I don't know how to listen to it, but anyway.
Shut up, mom. Who do you know? Who do you know?
Email it, woman. It took pretty much by the end of that first book, so 24 episodes. It got up to the 10,000 mark, and numbers have fluctuated higher and lower since then. But I was putting out press releases that were getting picked up, you know, Technorati and other instant online services, knowing that, hey, it shows up in your blog reader. There's a link, click, and in 3 seconds, you're actually listening to me tell one of my stories. And within 5 minutes, you know whether you like it or not.
And was there any part of you that thought, like, you know, well, what if they just take this on the audio part and then the book part, they're going to, you know, was there any fear that they were going to, because I'm sure this is what the big companies are like, yeah. Well, if they listen to it, they're not going to read it with their eyes.
My agent told me, don't do it. Just don't do it. It's going to screw up your audio rights. And if you don't have audiobook rights, that'll screw up a print deal. And you know, everybody in the industry is like, why on earth would you give it away for free? And I'm not entirely sure, but I think Cory Doctorow was already giving away free PDFs in 2005 or at least 2006. He's way ahead of the curve on all this. And I was just like, I just completely ignored all of them. I'm like, you guys cannot see the math. There's 500 million people online. Most of them right now are speaking English. What's wrong with you? How can you not see that this is a great way to, it's a great way to build up followers and build up an audience. And if you get in front of enough people and you write good stuff, if they like your stuff, a certain percentage of them are going to become diehard converts who want to buy everything that you put out.
Right.
Because I think everybody online, nobody's upset about paying for stuff. We're all a bunch of nerds. And if I'm going to buy, you know, the Battlestar Galactica bonus DVD set, I don't care what it costs. I'm buying that. Mm-hmm. I just want to know that when I spend my money, I'm going to get something that's worth my money. So that, to me, is what giving away all my stuff online does. It shows people, yeah, I'm so good at what I do, I can give it to you for free, and you'll still wind up paying for it because you want to. So that's kind of the mentality.
That's genius. I mean, I have that, I kind of have that back and forth thing with stand-up all the time. I'm like, should I just put the stand-up online for free? And I do a lot of it on the, you know, I do some of it on the live podcasts that we do, but stand-up, I mean, I guess it's as limited a resource as a book. I mean, you know, you're not going to write a new book every week.
Well, so. I would think with what you do and, you know, like the bits you're doing for the Craig Ferguson, the opening of the Craig Ferguson piece, you know, like the Vagina Amazing thing, like that, you know, little bits like that dropped into the feed, especially, you know, the context of a specific joke or bit, a bit less like 1 or 2 minutes, you know, people are just going to email that stuff back and forth. If they're not sending the links, they'll send the actual piece. I mean, if I was in your shoes, I would think that the more you give away, the more people are going to be willing to pay to come to your live shows because they want to see you and see those.
Well,
bits.
Obviously, live show, and that's the interesting. That's a good point too, because live shows for a comedian, you know, obviously you can't perform if people don't show up.
Right.
So, do you do a lot of touring now in terms of live engagements?
Yeah, I'm on tour right now. I just did 9 cities in 9 days, and I'm home for the 4th of July weekend,
and then I
go back out. Yeah, so I've got...
Like a fucking rock star.
It's pretty crazy. 9 cities in 9 days.
Bus full of blowjobs.
A lot of hotels. It's hard.
Here I come, Topeka.
Life on the road is hard. And then I've got 10 more when I go out again, so...
what are you doing on these? I
go to a bookstore and I do a short 50-minute reading for one of the books, and then I largely go into a Q&A because I've given away 8 full free unabridged novels, 3 short story collections, and a bunch of other stuff online. So there's a lot of information. My regular fans want to come out and ask questions about how the universe works, how stories are interlinked. Mm-hmm. So it's out there. Get in the bookstore, meet the bookstore people, promote the current novel, which is Ancestor, and then talk about whatever they want. Then after an hour and a half, we all go to the bar and get pissed. So it's that's kind of the culture right now. It's 9 cities, 9 days, and 9 bars. So
9 bars, nice. Yeah. Well, that sort of reminds me, do you know Jonathan Colton?
Yep.
Colton's a great guy. I love that guy. And he also did that, you know, he was like, I'm going to give away a song a week. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember how long he did it for, but it was an impressive amount
of
time.
A year, I think, or something.
Was it an entire year?
I think so, yeah.
It was... fucking genius. Mm-hmm. And you know, now he, you know, he found his audience found him and he found them, and you know, he plays, you know, big venues now, and people love
well,
him.
Well, it's just, you know, everybody's so friggin' busy and everybody's got their own life, and the analogy I use is from the fiction world. People like Stephen King, Dean Koontz, Anne Rice, when they got signed, it was a completely different universe. You had 3 channels plus PBS. You had 1 movie in your movie theater. You had the daily newspaper and the radio, and that was it. And now, people's entertainment. You know, there's 500 channels, there's Metroplexes, video games, which didn't even exist back then, are now the biggest entertainment industry in the world. And, of course, that pesky thing called the internet.
Right.
So fighting for people's attention to like, hey, I've got a really good product that would make you happy and you would enjoy it, try it out, is almost fucking impossible. So if you give stuff away, people are like, okay, I'll give this a shot. I don't waste any money. I mean, with your stuff, I'll waste 2-3 minutes. If I don't like them, I won't listen anymore. Yep. And that's what lets you make that connection with the audience where they go, this is the kind of stuff I've been looking for. This makes me laugh. This is what I want to spend my money on.
It's interesting because it's not really, you know, the entertainment business has shifted in the last 10, well, maybe 20 years, 15 to 20 years. And it's not a portal-driven business anymore in the sense of, you know,
AOL.
Well, yeah. Well, like in the old days, you just had one or two troughs that you could go consume from, and now it's I can go anywhere pretty much and get any kind of entertainment. And yeah. You know, do you feel that when you're giving a stuff away for free, does it lose any value if someone's not even paying a penny for something? Do they take it for granted because you know they didn't have to pay for it?
There is some of that, but you know, I have two options when you think about it. I can either be in bookstores, and maybe I'm lucky enough to be placed in the front of the table or on an end cap for the 2 weeks that the book is out.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes into the stacks, and it's spine out amongst, you know, 10,000 other books.
Right.
Even if I'm in the horror section, the science fiction section, there's literally thousands of books there. So the odds of someone stumbling upon me are pretty minimal, if non-existent. They're not just going to stumble on my book and read it. Maybe once in a great
literally
while.
Trip and fall and break their nose on the spine of your
book. That's what you have
book.
To do. I mean, if I could be in the store hitting people in the nose with the book and not get arrested for it, that'd be good marketing.
Now, if you did that, I would videotape it and put it on my television show.
Awesome. It'd be amazing. But, I mean, that's one option. The other option is give everything away, and then people find you that way because they're talking amongst themselves and they'll try because it's free and they don't have to get off their dead ass. They can sit on their desk at work and they can listen. They throw it on an iPod. Listen, they're driving around. So my audience reach by giving everything away is so much larger. I hit many thousands of people more. Out of those thousands of people who would have never otherwise heard of me, a certain percentage of them wind up buying stuff. So that it's overall, it's a positive. I think it could hurt somebody like a Stephen King if he's giving everything away for free.
Right.
Because people will use that to prejudge. I've heard a story like this before.
Stephen King reading Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
And then they buried Gage in the pet cemetery. That's the worst. That's not a good Stephen King.
That's not him.
Also, I really want him on the podcast, so if I do a voice of him, he's probably going to be like, I'm not going on that.
He might come on. He's really adept at all the new media stuff and has been for a really fucking long time. I am not. I've never met him.
Okay.
He's my kind of my idol. I've never met him, but he's been doing shit outside the mold for forever. Going back to the Mist LP back when.
Well, I gotta tell you, when I was in high school, I was 15 years old, and I was at I was living in Denver at the time, and there was like the local swimming pool or whatever, and so there are all these other kids around trying to impress girls and live the Abercrombie and Fitch lifestyle that was, you know, soon to descend upon America. And there I am in the corner, in the shade, covered in SPF 50, reading Pet Sematary. I'm surprised anyone ever talked to me when I was 15 years old.
My best Stephen King nerding out story is that my mom was a big Stephen King fan, and that's how I got into it. So I would always, every Christmas, I would buy her Stephen King, and then I would read them before I wrap them up. So it was like I would do the mistake of opening up, read the first paragraph, be like, ah, screw it, I got to read this. And it was Silver Bullet. And, my mom thought I had discovered porn many years before I actually did, because she would come walk in my room and I would hide something beneath the desk. Hi, Mom.
No, this is for you.
Yeah, and then she's like, what are you doing? Nothing. And I was reading her Christmas present. So, yes, an SPF 90 is what I need. I'm very pale and corpse-like.
That's really funny. And weirdly enough, I refer to masturbation as reading my Christmas present. So I don't know if that's just a weird coincidence.
I guess it's a phase all boys go through.
I mean, everyone's got to read their Christmas present at a certain time. You get those urges. The worst part is when you're at sleep and then you read your Christmas present, you know, in your dreams.
The worst part is when you have to go out to Christmas tree and unwrap it. And oh, wait, never mind. That's a different analogy. Sorry.
That's an entirely different analogy. So once you finish this tour, what happens? Are you done with Ancestor completely? Do you have to, you start the next book? Have you already, do you know what that next book
is? The next book, the first book I wrote was Infected, and then I wrote Contagious. Those are in stores, and there's a third book to that trilogy called Pandemic. So that's me being clever. It's Infected. Oh, now it's Contagious. Oh, then it's a Pandemic.
The Bourne Ultimatum.
It's crazy. That will be, I'll start working on that August 1st, and that will hopefully be out Halloween 2011, and then going on from there. And then I have... those are through Crown, which is a subsidiary of Random House, so getting to play in the big time a little bit is really fun. Then on the other side of things, my I have an imprint called Dark Overlord Media, which my my business partner, A. Kovacs, and I put these books out ourselves. She's a huge fan of yours, by the way, so she'll be tickled with hearing her name on your podcast.
But Kovacs, we put out, Kovacs.
There you go. We put out these insane book series of books called The Rookie, which I say is Star Wars meets Any Given Sunday meets The Godfather.
Well, I have a copy of that right here. You do. This is like a professional kind of show or something.
And we put those out ourselves. We're able to do hardcover, load them up with all kinds of crazy nerd color inserts with pictures of the aliens playing football and stuff. And it sounds far gayer than it actually is. It's actually quite interesting.
This is awesome. These awesome kick-ass space helmets that are like... It's like a cross between a space helmet and a football helmet, and they've got crazy alien stuff on the side.
But we're pretty hardcore with making aliens that are biologically sound and, you know, are not just people with bumps on their noses. And then the positions of it are based on, you know, you have to have the gigantic creatures playing line and the incredibly fast creatures playing receiver and defensive back. And then largely the football and the teamwork becomes a metaphor for how sports overcomes racism, at least in America. I've heard in Europe it's not doing so well, but... First black person I ever saw was on a football field. So I grew up in an all-white community. So this series is young adult, and it's kind of using future sports as a metaphor for how sports overcomes racism. And it's just super freaking cool, too. I have a lot of nerds saying, I never liked football until I read this, and now I understand it.
So. I will read it. I mean, I'm an idiot when it comes to... I mean, I don't understand sports very well. Like, it's just like...
It's mystical.
It is mystical because, you know, it's a situation... where people are rooting and they're like, that's my team. And I'm like, you're just sitting there getting fat on hot wings. That's not really your
which
team.
Which is glorious, don't get me wrong.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Beers and hot wings and a bunch of other fat people around you is a good time.
You're going to want to go, you can't really take credit for the people who train every day and devote their lives.
It's just, it's very, it's a real throwback to our tribal instincts. And, you know, you've got your colors and your team and you've got something to cheer for, and it's a pretty good time. But I specifically wrote this because I'm... half jock, half nerd, and it's a very strange grouping. And I had so many of my nerd friends who would look down on football, and I'm like, you guys have no idea of the computational requirements of a quarterback and what they have to, the math they have to do in their head in 3 seconds while someone is trying to kill them is pretty significant. So I kind of wrote this book so you're following the main character along, and in the process you're learning about football, and an enormous amount of nerds have read this and go, I like it now. I never understood that you actually had to think to play football.
I'm interested. I'm interested. I mean, I played chess in school. So
I heard that on one of the podcasts.
So for me, just the idea of the strategy of, you know, moving a bunch of, if I could dehumanize them and see them as pieces, then maybe it would make more sense in my head.
Here's the random chess analogy. So an ancestor chess is an ongoing metaphor for the plot developing. And I like to play chess. I'm just not very good at it. I got a nerdy internet guy email this morning. Loved your book. It was awesome. However, I'm sure you know by now that a knight cannot block a rook from putting something in check. I'm just like, oh, for God's sakes. There's no way you can control all the details in a book. But I saw that one. I'm like, yeah, I probably should have known that. But now it's in print, so all the chess people will think I'm an idiot when they read my book.
Now, I played tournament chess, and I have to be honest. I would like to pretend like I know everything. I'm not familiar with that rule that a knight cannot block a rook from putting something in check.
Because it goes over, apparently, and not through. So,
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I saw this morning. I was embarrassed. Not that embarrassed because you know I don't play a great deal of chess.
I'm embarrassed for not knowing that because I played tournaments for years, and I don't ever
good,
remember.
And I have your seal of approval on my mistake.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, yes, of course. As the host, it'd be very easy for me to be like, "How could you not know that?" But I got to be honest. I don't want you to feel bad because I can't play chess anymore though. It's too intense for me now. Like I can't.
You get the sweats, shakes.
Well, you know, when you do something as a kid, it's embedded into my skull. It's so competitive that I can't sit down without like okay, I need to think 12 moves ahead for every piece. Like, it hurts my head to play anymore. I can't just play for the fun of it. No. And I've tried.
I'm the same way with any kind of pickup sport that I play at all. There's no such thing as playing for fun. You are trying to kill the other guy, and that's just the way it is.
There was one funny... Jim Belushi takes a lot of shit from the comedy community.
Does it?
Yes, he does. There was an amazing sketch that he did on SNL 25 years ago where he was a Bobby Knight-style chess coach.
Oh, I saw that shit. That was awesome.
Knight to Rook 4! Jesus Christ! He was kicking over chairs. That was a phenomenal sketch.
That was pretty good. I think he also did the run, throw, and catch like a girl Olympics, too, which was another great sketch. He was awesome back then.
If only we could dig that up somehow on a web of information.
It's probably on some site that shows tube videos.
Maybe.
I don't know.
You're talking... Okay, future man. You know, but the point of view, like what I get from you, which I think is fascinating, is that when you say you're a science fiction writer, it's really a bold face on the science.
Yeah.
That it's not, it's not so much sci-fi. It's like science... That happens to be fictional.
It's all of the books that are in stores anyways, because we sell the Rookie and that series ourselves off the website. But the books that are in stores, it's all modern day people like you and me. And it's in current setting with current political climate. And there's just some insane sci-fi biology backdrop to the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, which is part of the problem I had getting published in the first place. Like, well, you're not horror because you're not writing about vampires, and you're not science fiction because it's not in a spaceship, and you're not a thriller because people are getting dismembered and blood splatters everywhere.
Yeah.
So they didn't know what shelf to put me on. So these are largely... they're thriller novels. They're paced like a James Cameron movie. They're meant to have a gigantic cinematic finish at the end. But they are, you know, they're modern day, and the hard science scared a lot of people away.
There's not a biological hypothetical section in the bookstore.
Surprisingly, there's
criminal.
There's not, you know, biological mutants with real, genuine hard science. And technically, we can actually do all of this. We just haven't yet sectioned.
Do you actually sit down with scientists?
Oh yeah. With the podcast, by giving everything away, the two things I never saw coming was. All of the feedback I would get from fans pointing out my mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
Which, a lot of times it's annoying, but a lot of times, like, yeah, a helicopter doesn't start that way. That's wrong. Like, how the fuck would I ever know that? I don't fly helicopters. So it's turned out to be great, particularly in the military and weaponry areas. I've now got people that read, four or five people that read the book cover to cover before it comes out to make sure I have all that stuff right. And then I've got three biology PhDs who are fans who emailed me out of the blue to say, I like what you're doing. If you need any help with this stuff, I'd be happy to read your books for you beforehand. So I call myself the only peer-reviewed horror author out there. These guys read it from cover to cover. They point out stuff that's incorrect. They make suggestions for other, like, we just discovered this yesterday. You got to put this crap in there. So it makes it really hard to write a book because that stuff screws up my outline and I have to change it. But at the end of the day, now I'm to the point where, you know, guys who do this stuff for a living can read the books and really enjoy them because everything is as accurate as you can get it while remembering I'm still telling an over-the-top thriller story. So the story goes first, the science is second, but it's real science. And if you know anything, even pop culture science, it feels very real and very plausible to you. So when you get to the crazy parts with the dismemberments and et cetera, you are totally in and you allow yourself to be scared.
So you don't start a helicopter with a hand crank?
That's you not do how not. That works?
Okay.
You do not. And you also can't run and jump into one like you would like a horse in the Old West.
Really?
You can't do that.
Slide across the front? Like if your helicopter were painted like the General Lee, you couldn't slide across the little snub nose of the helicopter and
there's
hop
no,
in?
There's no Starsky and Hutch old school starting
Wayne,
up at the
Wayne
car.
Wayne Jennings couldn't go, them two boys is flying overhead once again. Like, you wouldn't get that?
You would not get that.
But, all right, so clearly what we've learned today is that I can't write about helicopters.
Yep.
But I know you made this point, but I think it is a very important point that as an author, as much as you can keep people in the world, and since your world is, you know, as much reality as possible, that all those details are really important.
They're super important because, I mean, you can't get everything right, and sometimes you have to take liberties, but... You know, if some girl's been over in Iraq and has been shot at and put in a tour over there, and then she's trying to read this book and enjoy it, and you don't, you know, you get little things like unit insignia wrong, or you have the wrong part of Iraq, or you don't even know how an Uzi operates, which is something I got wrong that the girl fixed for me.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know how an Uzi operates. It just immediately takes them out of the story. So even though it's a small percentage of the people are reading your book, they know that you just didn't bother to go online and basically learn how something works. You didn't take 5 minutes to show respect to what they do. And it's in all disciplines all over. So all of those things are little landmines that remind people, oh, I'm not in a story. I'm reading some jackass's book.
And the films do it all the time instead of sucking you into a world. The way that they get around that shortcut is when you're in a movie and then someone goes, this isn't a movie, you know.
Well,
nothing takes me out of a film faster than this is not a movie.
That's why I'm really happy that people are reading the book in one go. Mm-hmm. And that's my goal when I set up to write stories. I want to sweat the details, put in the wrench time, make everything as accurate as I possibly can so that they forget they're reading and they realize it's 4 o'clock in the morning and they finish the book. Like I've done with Stephen King books many times. Like, how the fuck did it get to be 5 a.m.? What happened?
Well, that's what happened when Jessica reviewed your book. She said she couldn't put it down. And then mm-hmm. people in the comments section were like, I had the same experience, you know? So
it's pretty cool.
That is amazing.
That's my nerd life. It's pretty cool. It's pretty awesome. Yeah.
But I also want to talk a little bit about your writing process. Cause selfishly, I sold a book. Cool. And but it's a nonfiction book, mm-hmm. and so then I sold it, and you know I did the proposal. I had to like revamp the proposal like 3 times, and so I finally sold it, and then I had this immediate anxiety of, oh, I hadn't really thought through that I was gonna have to write this. It was just more in the, I got so excited about the mm-hmm. idea of selling a book, and then I did. So now I'm stuck with I have to write it. So yes. What's your process? Do you use software? Are you all notebooks? How do you organize your outlines? Like, how do you write?
Well, I use a program for the Mac called Scrivener.
Uh-huh, I know Scrivener.
Scrivener's...
Is that Mariner software?
I'm not sure. No, okay. It's something in latte. It's a coffee name for the software.
Okay.
But Scrivener is only like 30, 40 bucks, and it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's got good folder structure, outline. It makes a fake corkboard with 3x5 cards. No matter how you like setting stuff up, it lets you set it up. I mean, I use it for a folder for each chapter, and then you can write documents inside and move everything around and reshuffle. So it's very helpful for that. And then I have to take my 4 or 5 scientific concepts I'm trying to convey in the book, put together an outline. Then I spend weeks or a month or so on the outline. Then I start writing the first draft. And for me, being fiction, it's a pain in the ass because pretty soon the characters stop doing the things I want them to do. My characters are pretty good at saying, yeah, I'm not going in the haunted house alone at night. Not going to do that. So then I butcher through the first draft, and then I have to re-outline and redraft. And usually by the third draft, that's when it gets turned over to the scientific community, and they tear it apart from there. And then for me, there's always... I kind of describe my books as a satanic Seinfeld episode. So there's 4 or 5 different plot threads that seem completely unrelated. Then you get to the end and like, oh, I see how this all connects now. So everything has to line up. So every time I change one thing, it's a house of cards that knocks down everything else, and I have to just keep rewriting until I get it right. And now I have help from, you know, the editors at Crown, mm-hmm. who are good at... They're interesting people because they're like, well, I can't write a novel, but I can tear the crap out of yours. And they're very good at tearing the crap out of it. And then it just... Rewrite, rewrite, rewrite till you get it done. That's kind of how it works in the fiction world. I mean, what is yours about?
Mine is sort of it's kind of a productivity book.
Oh, okay.
I was initially pitching it as self-help, and that means something a lot different when you're talking to publishers, and they're like, self-help? Oh, well, you're not really a doctor. And I'm like, no, but I was a fuck-up for a long time when I was younger, and then I managed to turn that around somehow, mm-hmm. and so I kind of want to... You know, my I have this idea that the nerd brain is very specific. Like, it's a group of people that I refer to as creative obsessives. Like, nerds are able to focus on something almost to an unnatural degree. And so the idea of the book is, you know, just kind of walking people through steps for, you know, here's how you can kind of refocus some of that into constructive areas to sort of fix things or get things that you might want to get done in your life.
I mean, if I had it to do over again, I would go back and write nonfiction. And I would start blogging about something, become an expert on it, and then write nonfiction, and those books sell like crazy.
Well, nonfiction is relatively measurable. I mean, like, you can try some things out, and then, okay, this is what I did, and these are the steps, and this is how... But, you know, when you're writing fiction, it's almost restrictive because you can literally write about anything. Mm-hmm. And when you have that... It's you sort of It's like going to the internet and just kind of staring at Google and like, what do I want to learn today?
I'm going to follow, or the one I just will never get, stumble upon. I'm bored. I'm going to start stumbling through random links and see, like, really? How can this be so popular? Who's got time to go, I got nothing to do. I'm going to stumble some shit.
Oh, lots of people have time. Lots of people have time. I've been through some small towns where it's like, these are the people that have time. You go to a town that just has, the advent of the... of that sort of ubiquitous strip mall that we all see now. Yep. It's got the Applebee's in it and maybe a Barnes & Noble and a Walmart. Mm-hmm. and whatever. Those little clusters, even 20 years ago, those weren't really... Like, I don't know what people did in those towns at that point.
I grew up in one of those towns.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Sheboygan, Michigan.
Sheboygan?
Sheboygan, Michigan. And we had... one movie theater, I think we had three stoplights. So, I mean, there was not a lot going on. Thank goodness, being the raging nerd that I am, we had Dungeons and Dragons and Champions, and me and my buddies, instead of going out drinking, which that was all there was to do in Sheboygan, unless it was deer season.
Mm-hmm.
Deer season, combined with drinking, made for good, fun times.
Yes, and accidental deaths.
Yeah, no big deal. Make sure there's an orange collar on your dog because it's going to get shot. But we, there was nothing to do, and we wound up role playing all the time.
It just unfortunately overlapped with Dress Your Dog Like a Deer Day. A terrible idea.
Come here, Mookie. I got you some fake antlers.
Kapow!
We had, we would lose people every year in hunting season and then in ice fishing season. Because that, of course, another thing that you drink heavily at, and then the ice fishing roulette where people would see how long they could stay out on the ice as it started to break up.
Do you have one of those little outhouse huts?
Yep, outhouse huts, drill a hole in the ice, drop a line through it, and get pissed drunk. That was entertainment.
Did you ever catch anything?
No. Okay. No. Well, I wasn't really, I'm like, you guys, this is... a large sheet of frozen water and you're going to sit out on it for a long time and then drink, hypothermia, you're going to freeze to death. So wasn't too big into that.
Maybe the fish were circling underneath getting plowed, just watching the people.
It's like fish TV. But it was an amazing place to grow up because we would have our missing persons reports. And if their truck was also missing, then you knew their truck had fallen through the ice too late in the season. And they were just gone and sad, and that's the way it was in Sheboygan.
Now, when you were playing D&D on the ice, what type of characters did you tend to go for?
I immediately started being the game master, like right off the bat, and I honestly attribute a lot of my storytelling ability to
DM.
Endless hours of DMing. And then we got away from Dungeons and Dragons because this is as geeky as it gets. As a storyteller, it was too restrictive. I couldn't have continuing plot threads and every recurring villains coming back. I was like, I can't tell a story of this crap. So we moved into a superhero role-playing game called Champions, which we played for years. And I had ridiculous notebooks of source material and would just, I was able to keep 7 or 8 high-strung teenage boys riveted all the time.
Boy, does it get any nerdier than, these games? Because when D&D first got popular, then there was this explosion of... Boot Hill was another one, which was the Western. I can't remember what the space one was called.
Space Hero, I'm afraid. Space Hero, and that was one of them. Good.
But I was saying, does it get any nerdier than... fantasy meets math. Like you've got your fantasy part and then your probability.
There is nothing nerdier than that. And I think it's dead now because it was you being able to be an adventurer, pretend to be something else, and now you can do that. Halo blows anything completely out of the water.
Right.
But it was as nerdy as nerdy gets. But I just from square one, I would spend hours off game writing plots and coming up with storylines and characters and trying to find ways to push people's buttons so that they would lose themselves in the story and get a big thrill out of it. So it was fantastic on the job training. And then from there I started to write for the game companies. I'm a fairly arrogant guy, and I would be like, these books suck, I can do better than this. And I would write them letters, say, these suck. I was the original internet guy. your stories are retarded. And they were like, fine, why don't you write one? I'm like, fine. And I did. And then I wrote a couple of gaming books, and then that's what got me into writing novels and shit.
That's fantastic. So, this is a case where nerd arrogance actually paid off.
It did.
Yeah. I think every nerd kind of has that. Because, sometimes when nerds write you, they're more kind of stretching their creative writing wings than anything else. Like, they go out of their way to try to flay you as eloquently as possible rather than just saying, like, you suck balls.
It's... Sometimes I think of it, people who shouldn't have an audience, their one chance to have an audience. You know, they can start a flame war, they can come out something. It's very exciting as a writer to write something and have other people respond to it. And sadly, a lot of times that's what the people are doing. Like, yes, I'm going to get attention.
I get people are generally very nice to me on email, Twitter, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, I do get some shitty, as you do, you know, as you do.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But I got an email that was so. Like, it felt like it had been flash fried in sarcasm. It was just like, and on your podcast, why don't you do this more? Because that's amazing. You know? But, so at the same time, I was, my ego was bruised by it. You know, so I wrote the guy and I was like, well, you know, thanks for your feedback. Here's why I do all this stuff and I'm not trying to bum you out. And here, you know, mm-hmm. And he wrote back and he actually apologized. And I wrote back to him and I was like, totally cool. But just so you know, I hope that whatever you're doing in life involves writing, because as brutal as your email was, it was actually pretty well written. So I hope that, you know,
you're an eloquent asshole. Thank you, sir.
By the way, please, this is not a call for people to send me emails that are brutal.
Exposition, I think, is what he's looking for.
You are a sack of failure crap. No, please.
Oh, I've had to get used to, because when I started out with a podcast, part of my goal was, everyone who reached out to me was going to get replied to all the time. So if they...
But you want to do that, and then after a while,
well, you know, I my Twitter followers, I tried to do the math on what small percentage of mine yours are, and like, I don't know how you can even manage that many. You can't. You just... The 1.3 million people follow
you. But it's not... You know, of that percentage, you know, like I'm sure there are spam bots, and of that percentage, there are people who signed on and never used the service again.
It's impressive. It's impressive.
I do get a lot of replies, but you know, not every one of them necessarily warrants some kind of response. And I do try.
That was kind of what helped build my fan base at first. Was I had a voicemail line. Every voicemail line got played. I respond to every blog post, people tweeting. This is before Twitter, but people out there blogging about me, I'd go on their blog and respond. And I had a really hard time getting used to those kind of emails. And then when the first book came out, I was such an amateur at this game that I was responding to people's comments. Every review on Amazon, I was responding to it, which, like Gary Vaynerchuk does, uh-huh. But Gary Vaynerchuk's the master of a wide variety. He's just a completely different animal. I wasn't as nice as Gary Vaynerchuk was. I was like, I worked on this book for 10 years, so suck my cock, you bitch. I had a tough time getting used to the fact that there was going to be this... vehement diatribes against what you do, because no matter what you do, somebody out there doesn't like it. So I've had to get used to that, like you, and just not, you know, not only that,
but it's also, I mean, I guess maybe because if you're involved in a creative field, I don't know if this is true for you, but for me, you're kind of harder on yourself than most people are. So when someone attacks you, you instantly go, oh my god, fuck, they're right, you know, because you just feel like, well, the house of cards is going to topple now. But I think what's hard is that when people write really negative stuff, you don't know if it's authentic or if they're just having a bad day. I mean, sometimes people have written stuff when I've been like, oh, I'm sorry you feel this way. And they go, I just broke up with my girlfriend. I'm sorry. And you were just the catalyst that just sort of made everything bubble over at that moment.
I'm very, very hard on myself. And that's been getting used to them. Like, you put so much effort into these things. And the ones that would bother me, the ones that they clearly hadn't read the book. Like, I get a lot of negative reviews that pick things apart. I'm like, you know, that's incredibly valid. If you had told me that before, I would have fixed X, Y, and Z. Then you get the ones where people just, they literally haven't read it. They've read 10 pages. Oh, you're a misogynist, you hate women, and you've got stories about killer cops. No, none of these things are true. Finish the book and see how the heroine pulls it out at the end. So those I had a tough time responding to. Now I'm better at ignoring it, because I have to be. Because I'm like, you know, I'm very hard on myself. Or like Ozzy was in your Ozzy interview. You know, he's like, yes. And people who try and aspire to a higher level are usually very, very hard on themselves.
What an amazing guy he was.
That was cool, dude. I'm sorry. I was listening to that at the gym the other day. I'm like, that's fucking cool. You get to sit down with Ozzy? That's awesome.
I know. And you know, I mean, of course, I'm very familiar with Black Sabbath, and you know, but I'm not. I mean, I'm familiar with Ozzy's solo work. Mm-hmm. You know, like all the kids when I was in grade school had the Ozzy thing on their fingers, and "Bark at the Moon" was a huge video, and whatever. But I'm not really a metalhead like some people. So my questions were more from a You know, I'm very curious to know how your brain works rather than, Ozzy, what was it like when you were playing Wembley? Like, I didn't have any of those questions. And it was fascinating because he's such a contemplative guy, and he's genuinely grateful, A, to be alive, yeah, and B, that yeah, he's still able to do, you know, what he's been doing for all these years.
That was a really fun interview to listen to because he clearly has his priorities in the right place when he's right, talking about, yeah, they're not privileged to see me, I'm privileged to see the fans.
And he really, I was sitting in front of him, he genuinely means it. Like, mm-hmm, it's not something that he just kind of says.
And did you see his viral video for Scream? Have you seen this?
No.
Oh my God. He's got really smart people around him, I'm sure. I don't know if this was his idea, but it was at the Wax Museum.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and yes, I did see that.
Oh, my yeah, God, that was great. You're like, this guy's been in the game for 40 years before any of the new media came around, and he's just got the magic touch. He's like, well, I'll go do this, and now I've got 5 million views on YouTube. It's insane.
It was a pretty genius, and you could pretty much only be Ozzy to make that work. Guys, if you for anyone listening, just Google Ozzy and Wax Museum. It's a terrific video.
Or Joan Rivers could get away with that, too.
Joan Rivers.
She can pull that off, no problem.
As I'm sure you remember. This wax figure won't shut the fuck up about, why does this wax figure keep asking me if we can talk? I don't understand why it won't stop. Stab it.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's not wax. It's made of ash and dark magic.
Not a fan. She's hysterical. Her stand-ups, going back, are hysterical. I can't get into the shows where your whole career is ridiculing and ripping on what someone wears. It's just like, that shit, I want to jab forks in my ears. I'm like, there's a whole channel dedicated to insulting what someone wears to an award show? Really? I hate that shit.
Yeah,
that
I mean, you know, it's. I don't love it, but I understand it, because as a performer, the longer you're in this business, I feel like one of the things we always try to do, if you're a writer, you're an actor, or a stand-up, or whatever, there's always a thing in the back of your head where you're just trying to find what your point of view is. You're trying to find what your voice is, and you're trying to figure out what you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I'm sure Joan Rivers, they hire her as, well, she's this sassy comedian who tells it like it is. And then she gets into the clothes thing, and all of a sudden it works for her. There's always something Darwinian that happens where you're like, where they kind of realize this was,
she's getting a paycheck, yeah.
Right. Or maybe it's not as Darwinian, and it's more, it's more Pavlovian, where it's like, oh, I'm getting rewarded for this behavior, and so I'll just keep doing this behavior.
Well, she's definitely no dummy, and she gets paid for it, but you're just yeah, like, oof, well, that's a tough... It's not a tough way to make a living, it's just, do something constructive and... I mean, you're fucking Joan Rivers, you've been in the comedy game forever, this is what you got, is insulting people all the time?
I just imagine that she's sitting in a chair like Catherine Hellman in Brazil, where they're just stretching her face back around in the back of her head.
That's a little crazy. And then her daughter, you know, the mother-daughter insult team. That's kind of nutty. But I'm glad. I'm glad they're working.
Yeah, I got trashed by Melissa Rivers once.
Did you really?
Yeah, it was actually when I went to the premiere of House of a Thousand Corpses.
What were you wearing? A sock on your cock or something like that? Rocking out your Chili Peppers fandom?
No, I was chunkier then because I was still on the booze, so I would not have been naked in public. But no, it was just like a black suit and like black sneakers.
Yep.
And like it was a thin tie, but it was a thin tie, kind of slightly before like everyone was like, oh, thin ties, and so she went through the. She kind of went through this play-by-play on the video with, like, circling stuff, like, and what's going on here?
Oh, geez.
And so after that, I kind of realized if like, because I was trying to figure out, like, what purpose Melissa Rivers served. And so I kind of thought, you know, if Joan Rivers were a buffalo, Melissa would be the only part the Native Americans would not have to do with. She's so, like, I instantly was like, what the fuck is your problem? I'm a dude wearing a black suit.
Oh my God! How did that feel when you're watching TV and you're watching someone completely critique? It's like being in the third grade again and getting made fun of because you're the kid with the Kmart T-shirt.
I'll tell you exactly how it felt, and this is because, honest as I can be about it, it was bittersweet because at the time I wasn't working as much, and so I was like, "Oh, I'm on TV. Someone's talking about me." So that fucking immature part of my brain is stimulated.
Okay.
But then at the same time, it's like, oh, but she's shitting on me. So it was this kind of like, eh, aww, kind of a feeling. And by the way, she was wrong. She was way fucking wrong. What I was wearing was awesome.
Well, skinny, the rockin' the skinny tie.
It's
Breakfast Club all over again. Let's get this done.
Hey, yeah. I was dressed like I was in the Hives. Come on, man. Cool band. But a cool band at the time. Still a cool band. I love the Hives. But what music do you like? What music do you listen to?
I am a metalhead. I'm largely I love Ozzy, and I've been listening to a lot heavier music. Like, I don't know if you've heard of these guys, Killswitch Engage, Trivium.
Yeah.
Bullet for My Valentine's a big one right now.
Yep.
All That Remains. I got to go see All That Remains, Lacuna Coil, and Maylene and the Sons of Destruction, or Sons of Disaster. And I remember, because the concert hall was like two blocks from my apartment here in San Francisco. So that's the kind of stuff I listen to. That, and then a crapload of Sinatra is the other big thing.
who was metal for his time?
He was as metal gets. That's like one of my, whenever I'm listening to Sinatra and tweeting, I'm like, fuck, was Sinatra metal? He was so metal, you bitches don't know. End tweet. And he was. I mean, if he was alive today, he would be, you know, he'd be biting the heads off chickens and throwing blood on the audience. He just, maybe not that regard, but he was so fucking cool. So that stuff. And then, I can't get away from the Christina Aguilera because of the pipes are just, you can sit and listen to that all day. And yes, I like Lady Gaga too. So metal and crazy dressing chick pop.
Now, I don't know much about, people that I've taught you, I had this conversation about Lady Gaga with Andy Richter, where I was like, yeah, I just don't understand. And he's like, I know, but for the type of music that it is, it's well done. And the more I see of her, the more I respect just this kind of path, this kind of mega theatrical path that she's taken in creating this whole, you know, insane persona.
There's two things with
her. It's fascinating as a writer.
There's two things. It's like Ozzy said on your interview, it's all about a melody. And she writes crazy hooks that you can't get out of your head. And the songs, I don't care what kind of music you like, the songs are just flat out catchy. That's all there is to it. And then the whole visual train wreck that is going on the few videos of hers that I've seen, you're like, I don't know what, I can't look away. What's happening? She's wearing sunglasses that are smoking. I don't.
Do you think maybe you might want to start touring as some kind of Gary Glitter style author?
I have given that some thought. You know, it's doing something to cut through and get some kind of attention. I don't know, not quite to that. I'm not going to be like David Bowie. Let's get androgynous with this shit.
Bowie.
Yeah, my voice doesn't quite fit into androgyny, which if you ever listen to my podcast has heard my female voices, and they are absolutely atrocious. Like, you sound like a drunk transvestite on there. I'm like, thank you very much. But
do you do the character voices?
I do all the character voices.
Fantastic.
I do, yeah. I'm like, we're over like 150 characters by this time. So
now, see, I'm torn because I actually want to read the book, but I also now I want to hear your characterizations of the book as well.
They're all free online, so you can go dig into them. Yeah.
Where, and so is it to scottsigler.com, or do you have
scottsigler.com is where I go, kind of do my thing, and also the weekly podcasts are posted there. Mm-hmm. So right now we're in the middle of Ancestors. So anybody listening to this can go to scottsigler.com, hear the first four or five episodes of Ancestor, and see if they dig it. And we give that away every week, so that's how I stretch it out for 24, 30 weeks, 5 months or so. And if you can sit and wait for the rest of the story, more power to you. It's all free. You get every word. If you get caught up in it and got to find out what happens, well, then hopefully you go out and buy the book. And then all the back stuff is archived at a place called podiobooks.com, which is podiobooks.com. And that's where I've got 7 full-length, unabridged free novels and a bunch of short story collections.
So, what's your recording setup like now?
Right now I have a 4x4 booth. I actually have a sound booth that I stumbled into. Got it for free. And an RE20 mic, which is, they're like, this is what they use in NPR. I'm like, okay. So that is lovely. And then I record, basically it all goes into a Mac Pro tower.
Do they give you the kind of the vocal compression that they get in?
I've got
everyone's voice sounds bassy and rich.
I think it's a VoiceMaster Platinum Pro, I think is what it is. And I have to use that because I started out recording in my closet in San Francisco, and we're right on top of a very busy street. So all the traffic noise, I had to find an insane noise gate and compression. Otherwise, it sounded like that all the time. And now the new place I'm at, it's the same problem. So that's pretty much
it's amazing. Just we're actually recording in San Francisco right now, and I've not heard any of the sirens that you would normally hear.
At the W Hotel 20 stories up, it's slightly different than in my tiny one-bedroom apartment, one floor above three lanes of nonstop 24-hour traffic. I'm just saying, it's a slight... if you're an audiophile, that's a slight difference.
They brought me cookies last night.
Did they? Oh, that's badass.
Well, they brought me cookies the night before, but they weren't for me. So this guy comes to the door, and he's got cookies and milk, and he was like... Mr. Brown, I have cookies for you. By the way, I'm not trying to racial stereotype. I'm just trying to imitate how the guy sounded.
Okay.
You can peg whatever ethnicity you thought he was. But he's like, Mr. Brown, I have cookies for you. And he hands me this note for Mr. Brown, and I'm a fucking idiot. So I go, I'm not Brown. And then he kind of walked away sort of dejected. And as soon as I closed the door, I was like, why did I just pass up three cookies? And so the next day, I told them at the hotel, I was like, oh, this crazy thing happened. And they were like, we'll send you up some cookies. So I actually did get my delicious cookies and milk after all.
Good.
That story was just about me. That had nothing to do with you, Scott. I'm sorry.
That's okay, but I'm going to have to get cookies later today. So that'll be good.
So are you going to branch out into other media? What are you looking to do?
Well, I've been doing a lot more video stuff lately. I'm trying to get more video out, watching a lot of the successful vidcasts, like, mm-hmm. Callie Lewis and other shows, Leo Laporte, shows like that. And, I mean, there's blogging and audio are one level, and then if you get a successful vidcast and people get to recognize your face, that's another level. And then the next level up is TV.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually to get to the TV level, because, the thing you realize is people who have been on TV or are on TV right now, their exposure is just... so much bigger. The internet's a big place and you can do really well and get a lot of followers there, but
there's just something about TV. It's difficult to compete.
You can't, and that's what I've come to the realization I've come to is you can't compete. So my grand business model is, besides publishing my own books and putting out books through Random House, I've got cool books in stores. If I can find a way to get in front of more people and a bigger brand name, I'm hoping the back end is a lot more people going to stores to buy those books and enjoy them.
So. Now, why hasn't a book like The Rookie, for instance, been made into a movie yet? I mean, like, fucking aliens playing football? Like, what could be better in a movie than that?
It's, I think, largely what it comes down to now is it's brand name and how many books have you sold. Mm-hmm. So if you've written, The Lovely Bones, and 7 million people have read your book, well, it doesn't really matter what kind of movie it's going to be. It's going to get made into a movie.
Not as good as Alien CG and Lovely Bones.
So I'm in the process of trying to get these things adapted, and I have a new movie guy now who's getting... we're getting no's from some really big-time players, which is really exciting.
that's actually an interesting way to put it. When you start getting rejected higher up the chain,
yep.
You can, in a weird sort of way, you can spin that into an optimistic kind of a, well, I made it to that level to get rejected.
It's similar to my philosophy with the books. I'm like, I don't care if I get a no. I just want to know I'm getting a fair shot. Like, mm-hmm. if I get a shot at the big time and then I don't sell enough books or I don't get the publishing deal, well, that's okay because I had my chance. I can't sit there and crying my milk and say, oh, nobody ever gave me a chance. I could have been a contender. I had a shot at it. It didn't pan out. I'm okay with that. So for the last 4 years, I've had a couple of different movie representatives who have not gone out hunting. Because for a guy like me, I don't have a big enough name that the doors are being kicked in by Spielberg. You got to have a guy who goes out hunting. So the new guy is hunting, and we're getting a lot of rejection. So shit's happening. It just hasn't broken through yet. So I'm really excited about that.
I wish it happened that way, where Spielberg would just fucking kick your door in.
It'd be awesome.
Just like a shirt, like rippling chest Spielberg chest.
I would want him holding Ripley's flamethrower from Aliens. And he kicks the door in, and he just stands there, and I'm like, nice tank top,
but
Spielberg.
But he's still very soft-spoken. I am Steven Spielberg, and I'd like to make your movie. By the way.
We can wish.
Can I just say for a second on a slightly related note, I just watched Alien Resurrection again. You didn't like it?
No, that's the one where she's cloned from a drop of her own blood.
Come on!
Oh my god, the science in that one made my nuts shrivel up and hide in my chest. I'm like, are you? So you clone her from a single drop of blood, yet she has all of her memories and personality, except now she's 6'8" and. The parasite that was in her chest is now suddenly back in her chest, somehow combining its DNA into the single cell of her blood. I lost it. I was having a very difficult time with that.
That's a very interesting take. I suspended my disbelief for all of that, and all I could think was, oh, crazy high alien hybrid human Ripley.
That had Ron Perlman in it, and which went a long way to making it awesome, but the science in that just, it was like... being gang raped by anti-nerds. I was very upset because I put a lot of super hard biology in my stuff, and it was how do you screw up Aliens? Like, there was Alien, masterpiece. Aliens, in my opinion, the best movie ever made. I'm a junkie for that thing. Mm-hmm. Then Aliens 3, see how angry I get for this?
You're very
this
angry
is my
at it.
This is my nerd on my sleeve. You have Newt in Aliens.
Yep.
Her whole culture, family, everything has been slaughtered. She's been terrorized by these things. If you want another strong female franchise character, there's Newt. 5 movies out of Newt, no problem. And they kill her in her sleep for Aliens 3. I was like, as a storyteller, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Okay, kill the soldier. He had like acid holes in his heart and crap like that. Fine. But you kill this girl who is a masterpiece of a character, as you could watch her grow and become this awesome hunter. Justifies going out and going after them. Way better than Buffy or anything like that. This would have been awesome. Kill her in her sleep, and then that, you know, the afterbirth that was Aliens 3, and then we get to Aliens Resurrection. I was very upset.
This was a powerful vein. I'm very excited about it. I wish I brought this up sooner. I actually have my I bought a Nostromo patch that they have.
Oh, did you?
Jackets.
Yeah, that's okay. I have a Battlestar Galactica Pegasus patch for mine, so equal in nerds. I admit it.
What I got you to do is that I'm gonna start this social network for nerds, and I'm gonna have everyone make a nerd collage where they basically just put all their nerdy stuff into a corner and then just take a picture of it. I have to get you to make a nerd collage.
Be happy to do that. Be happy to join in.
Make a nerd collage for us. Well, I think that's pretty much. That's our hour, like almost right. Exactly our hour. Scott, thank you so much for coming up to the hotel. Scott Sigler, infected, contagious, the rookie,
Ancestor,
which is
now.
The one that's just come out. Would you just please give a message to Jessica Barton, who hooked this all up inadvertently?
Yeah.
So if you just want to say something really,
Jessica, thank you so much for doing the review. Beers are on me. They would have been on me anyways, but just because you, thank you for writing about Ancestor. Now I have an excuse for it. It was really cool to see, and now I've got on this this great podcast, and this has been a thrilling experience.
Sloppy kisses, everyone. Scott, thank you so much. I'm so fascinated by your process and everything that you've accomplished, and I'm now I'm a fan of you personally. I'm really excited to see what kind of literary alchemy you can stir up in the coming years.
Well, give him a shot. And,
Newt fan fiction.
I wanted to write the screenplay for Aliens 3, so at a young age, I was very upset. I'm still pissed about that. I hope you enjoy the reads.
We're going to hug this out. The end.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.